It is Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. I'm Julie Englander, and we're talking plants with Extension horticulturists Richard Giron and Linda Nave. They'll take your questions about anything you want to grow or grow better. Call in at 1-866-780-9100. That number again, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Hello, Richard and Linda. How are you today?
Good morning. Just fine.
Thanks.
Good, good. I'd like to start off with something that Linda knows a lot about, well, you probably do too, Richard, but it's called the Spring Fever Mini Symposium at the Iowa Arboretum. It's about designing with perennial plants. What's that all about, Linda?
Well, it's a great opportunity for gardeners who have spring fever to get going in their gardens and to learn a lot more about it through a workshop with outstanding speakers. The speakers are going to be Scott Ogden and Lauren Springer from Fort Collins, Colorado. Lauren wrote a book called The Undaunted Garden, Planting for Weather Resilient Beauty. And now together, husband and wife team has teamed up to write a book called Plant-Driven Design, Creating Gardens That Honor Plants, Space, and Spirit. It's a great book, brand new, and they're going to be covering that in their discussion. They're going to be starting at 10 with registration and coffee, 10:30, the presentation called Plant-Driven Design, which they'll be talking about their design techniques that they've outlined in their book and specific plants that they recommend for our Midwest gardens. And then after lunch, and lunch is furnished with the workshop, they're going to be doing a presentation on designing with bulbs. So that's something we'll be real excited about, because we'll be seeing all the bulbs coming up, we'll seeing the availability of them, and how they can be integrated into our landscape. The cost for the workshop is $70 for non-members of the Iowa Arboretum and $60 for $60 for members of the Iowa Arboretum and $70 for non-members, with the opportunity that they can join the Arboretum, of course. And that'll include lunch, and you'll have an opportunity to buy and have them sign their book. And we will have some plants available for sale, in which the Ogdens and Lauren Springer will recommend and talk about. So some of those plants will be available that you can purchase to put in your own garden. So you're getting off to a good start with the book, the plants, and the information. To register, all one needs to do is go online and to www.iowaarboretum.org. iowaarboretum.org, and they can get more information and register right there. So it's going to be a great opportunity for garden enthusiasts who want to go that extra effort and extra step in their garden.
And the date again is what?
The date is April 17th, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. It's a Saturday at the Iowa Arboretum, April 17th.
Okay, that sounds great. Thanks, Linda. Mm-hmm. And just to for people to learn where to put the best plants were in the best place in their yard. We'll go now to our callers. Linda in Davenport is on the line. Linda, welcome to Talk of Iowa Horticulture Day. What's your
Thank
question?
You.
Hi.
My question, I have a clivia, and it almost looks like I started with one good-sized plant I bought at the Vandeveer Conservatory, and now it looks like there's three, and I'm wondering if I should divide them.
Mm-hmm. You can, but unless they're really pot-bound, I think I'd be inclined just to leave them as they are.
But if
they appear to be getting really, really tight in that pot and maybe a little bit too big for the pot, then I might divide them and repot those. But if they're not, I would be inclined to leave them as they are.
Okay. All right, because I don't get three blooms off of it. But, I mean, they've just really gotten more mature now. So should I get a bloom off each one of those?
Well, I think eventually you should, yes.
Okay.
And they like to kind of have a dormant period during the winter months where they're kind of cool, and usually that kind of encourages them to go ahead and bloom nicely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a sun porch, and I've started fertilizing them. So hopefully I'll get three this year then.
Okay, yes, hopefully.
Okay.
Thank you, Linda.
Much.
Good luck
okay.
with those.
Good
yeah.
luck. Thanks. All right.
We'll go next to Judy in Iowa City. Judy, welcome to Talk of Iowa. What's your question?
Hi. I have some bur oaks that are about 20 feet tall, and they have some low branches that are actually sort of in the way on the bottom of them. And I'm wondering, is it too late to cut back on them? I know you're not supposed to cut oaks very close to springtime.
Yeah, we typically suggest not pruning after March 1st.
Okay.
And the fear there is oak wilt. Now, let's say you only have one or two branches that you have to do. Then you still could do it, but you have to do one extra thing. As soon as you prune those branches off, paint the pruning surface with a latex paint and do that immediately. And that should prevent any potential problem because when you make a pruning cut in the spring, a certain amount of moisture will form at the pruning cut, and that moisture may attract the sap-feeding beetle that inadvertently carries the oak wilt fungus. So if you paint that immediately, then you won't have that moisture forming at the pruning cut, and you should be okay. But if you had to do large-scale pruning, I would wait and do that next winter.
Okay. And does it matter what color latex? I mean, do we do the, that black paint anymore? Or?
No, that doesn't really do any good. So okay. If you have some type of more neutral color, like maybe a tan or a gray or a green that kind of blends in, that would be best.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for calling, Judy. We appreciate it. We'll go next to Patty in Des Moines. Patty, welcome to Horticulture Day. What's your question for Richard and Linda?
I have moss in my lawn, parts of it. Full sun, partial sun, the shade. I need to know how to get rid of it and how to keep it from coming back in patches.
Well, moss is a very unique plant, and it can grow in very, very difficult sites, even on the roof of buildings, you know, like shingles and things like that. So it's a very adaptable plant. And the reason the moss is there is for some reason the grass has declined and kind of died out or become quite thin. And if you have an open environment, then the moss will kind of move in because it can grow almost anywhere, sun or shade, very poor soils, etc. So you could go out with a rake and actually rake it up. It doesn't really have much of a root system, so you can actually do that. But that's only a short-term solution because if the environment stays the same and there's no grass there, then the moss will move back in. So what you try to do is figure out why is the grass not doing well. And if you can correct that problem, let's say, for example, it's in the shade, and that's why the grass is thin. What you could do then is go out and rake off the moss, just kind of with a leaf rake or a lawn rake, and then you can go to the garden center and buy a shady lawn mix, a mix that should do well in the shady areas, and then basically sow the grass seed in that area and try to get some grass established. And if you can, and if the grass occupies all the given space, then the moss won't come back.
Does that do
it's
it?
Everywhere, in full sun, partial sun.
Well, moss will grow anywhere almost. There are a lot of different species, but the moss is there because there's no grass there. And so I would try to get a grass established, and in the sunny areas, obviously, I would choose a sunny seed mix and put that in those areas.
So rake it up and invade with grass.
Well, you can do that, yeah, and try to get grass in the area because that's why the moss is there. The moss is not killing the grass. The moss is simply moving in when you have a open space.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for calling, Patty. We appreciate it. We'll go next to Irving in Ames. Irving, welcome to Horticulture Day. What's your question?
My question relates to deer that have eaten off about half the leaves off the Japanese yews I have in front of my house. And I'm wondering if the leaves will come back in those areas where they're mostly all gone.
We have good news on that.
We have good news on that. And, you know, if misery loves company, you have a lot of company because it's happened so prevalent. Whether you are in a rural or an urban situation, the deer have fed, and right up next to homes, they have fed on the ewes. I'm one of those, too, that's in your company that the deer came up and ate. The good thing is you can prune that ewe back somewhat down to not low level, but almost to where the green is. It will come back, or if you don't want to do much pruning, those branches will re-leaf out. And you'll be surprised, even in one season, how well they re-leaf out. But let this be a warning to you that under situations like this, they're going to be back next year. So you might want to protect them next year because continual feeding may not be a good thing on them. But for this year, they will come back.
And yews are different than most other evergreens. If you had an evergreen like a pine tree or an arborvitae, and they have eaten off all that foliage, most likely those bare branches will not leaf out again. But yews are much more resilient, and they'll come back, and they'll leaf out on bare branches. So they're much more resilient.
Well, that's really good to hear. The leaves were left on the tops where they were covered with snow, but eaten off down the lower parts of the plant. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thanks for calling, Irving. We appreciate the call. If you have questions for Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron or Linda Nave, give us a call at 1-866. That's 1-866-780-9100, 866-780-9100, or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we do have an email from Karen in Marshalltown. She says, when will be the best date to seed the yard this year? My backyard has several large bare spots because of adding a patio. It is also a pretty shaded area.
Okay. As far as the best time to typically sow grass seed is actually late summer. That's basically late August, early September. But they can do it in the spring. And I would think typically around mid-April. Let the ground warm up nicely. And what they might want to do, since they're doing it in the spring, the biggest problem sowing grass seed in the spring is you tend to get a lot of weed seed coming up also when you sow grass seed in the spring. And so what you might want to do is go to the local garden center and find a starter fertilizer meant for starting a lawn in the spring that also contains a pre-emergent herbicide that will control most of the weed seeds but allow the grass seed to germinate. And so you want a very specific product, not the typical pre-emergent, but one meant for establishing a new lawn in the spring of the year. And the actual herbicide in there is Tupersan or Siguron, and that specific herbicide will control the weeds but not prevent the germination of the grass seed.
Okay. And Larry's email here, I don't know if it's related or not. He says, when snow on my lawn recently melted, I noticed spots of gauzy-like masses of delicate white filaments right at the surface of the grass, which disappeared when raked. Several other people I know reported seeing the same thing. What are we seeing, he's asking. Do you know?
Probably snow mold or something of that nature.
Okay, so.
Snow molds are very common. They're actually a fungus. And we see them in areas where you've had extended periods of snow cover. And that is basically most of Iowa. So we've had snow cover since early December, and in many cases quite deep. And so the actual snow is quite heavy, and it kind of compacts the grass, mats it down. And so you have this matted, wet environment, which is perfect for various fungi. And so in the spring of the year when the snow melts, you start to see these kind of gray patches or pink patches, and they're quite disturbing when you see those. But usually all you have to do is go out there and rake them, because right now they're matted, kind of wet.
Wow.
And if you rake those with like a leaf rake or a lawn rake and kind of fluff them up, you get better air circulation, it dries out better, and you provide an environment that's more favorable for the grass, and the moss or the actual mold simply kind of fades away.
Okay. We'll go now to Susan in Ames. Susan, welcome to Horticulture Day. What's your question?
Thank you. I've transplanted some peonies, some older established peonies this fall, and I'm wondering what can I expect from them this spring and summer?
Typically, peonies usually take a year or two to become established before they'll really bloom nicely for you, although you may get one or two blooms coming out. The best thing to do is don't over-anticipate your bloom, because it's not going to happen. So I would give it a few years, and if it doesn't bloom in a couple years, then I'd be a little more concerned. But typically the first year you're not going to get much. You just plant. Make sure when you're planting and dividing peonies that you don't plant them too deep, because that will inhibit bloom the following years.
Okay, thank you very much. Mm-hmm.
Thanks for calling, Susan. And we'll go next to Pat in Manchester. Pat, welcome to the program.
Good morning. I have a question about clematis. I have several different varieties of them, and I always have trouble remembering when I'm supposed to prune the different ones. That's my understanding. There's different times of year for different types of clematis.
Yeah, there are different types. There are actually three main types. There are varieties that bloom on the current year's growth, the new growth. There are varieties that bloom on strictly last year's growth, and there are varieties that bloom both on new growth and old growth. Okay, so it's kind of complicated, but
yeah.
But in Iowa, it's pretty easy. If for example, you have a clematis, and if you go out and look for signs of growth in the spring, Okay. And then when you find growth coming out on the vines, if you then find the uppermost growth, then cut it off just above that.
Okay.
And you're basically cutting out then just the dead wood. And no matter what type you have, that's the best that you can do.
Okay.
We have to take a break, but we'll be back in a few minutes, Pat, and maybe we expand a little bit on that. You're listening to Talk of Iowa Horticulture Day with Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron and Linda Nave. They'll take your questions in a few minutes. The number 866-780-9100.
No cap and trade, no cap and tax. Well, how about cap and dividend? This is the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham. There's bipartisan climate change legislation that's getting more attention lately. The CLEAR Act, Carbon Limits and Energy for America's Renewal, is better known around Washington as the Cap and Dividend Plan. It would tax fossil fuels at the source, whether a tanker of foreign oil coming into port or coal coming out of a mine. 25% of that money would be used to invest in cleaner alternative energies. The other 75% would be paid at a flat rate to each person in the nation in a monthly check to offset higher energy costs. A new study crunches the numbers of the proposed legislation. James Boyce at the University of Massachusetts Amherst is one of the authors. He says for most people, that monthly check will more than cover the higher cost of fossil fuels.
So for the typical family, they'll be paying more and higher prices on the one hand, and they'll be getting back a dividend check on the other hand.
Boyce says since people in the highest income brackets tend to use a lot more energy, they'll actually come up a little short. Boyce says this cap and dividend plan also has fewer loopholes to be exploited by special interests. This is the Environment Report. President Barack Obama recently killed the only place chosen to store spent nuclear fuel, radioactive waste. The government had spent more than $9 billion in tax money on Yucca Mountain in Nevada. But Sean Ali reports that money is just the beginning.
The Yucca Mountain Project claimed more money than just the $9 billion that's on the books. It also tied up cash from electric ratepayers and power companies. Let's start with the first group, ratepayers. Yucca Mountain was supposed to store the radioactive spent fuel left behind in nuclear reactors. The U.S. government charges power companies a fee to cover costs. Power companies pass that fee onto ratepayers. Bobby Baker serves on Georgia's Public Service Commission. He says now that President Obama took Yucca Mountain off the table, the federal government should return the money.
We were supposed to be shipping our spent nuclear fuel out to Yucca Mountain back in 1998. They were supposed to begin receiving shipments at that time. The only thing that's been done is the fact that, you know, Georgia ratepayers are continuing to pay into this trust fund and getting absolutely nothing for the money they've put into that trust fund other than a big hole in Nevada.
Georgia has a share of fees and interest that is more than $1.2 billion. In total, the federal government's collected $31 billion in fees and interest for the nuclear waste fund. The next group who paid extra for Yucca Mountain, power companies. By law, the federal government's supposed to take away radioactive spent fuel from nuclear power plants. But without Yucca Mountain, that waste stays put. John Rowe is CEO of Exelon, the country's biggest nuclear power company. Last year, Rowe explained the problem to the National Press Club.
We keep it in the spent fuel pools and watch it. And then when it gets to a certain level of coolness, we put it into concrete casks and put it on pads within the protected areas of our nuclear sites.
Rowe's company and other power companies sue the federal government to recover costs. The U.S. Government Accountability Office figures the government will lose those lawsuits, and it will owe power companies $12.3 billion within a decade. So far, the Yucca Mountain Project has cost or otherwise tied up about $60 billion. Cha-ching.
And we still don't have a place for that waste. That's the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham.
Support comes from the Park Foundation, the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation, and the Great Lakes Fishery Trust. You can find more information and post your comments at environmentreport.org. The Environment Report comes from the University of Michigan.
This is Iowa Public Radio, Talk of Iowa, and it's Horticulture Day. We're talking plants with Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron and Linda Nave, and they'll take your questions at 1-866-780-9100. Or email us, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we'll go to the phones now. Michelle in Ben Horn. I believe that's the area. Is that right, Michelle? You're in Ben Horn? Hello? Michelle? Yes, well, we'll move on now. I don't know where Michelle went, but we'll go to Sharon in Johnston. Sharon, are you there? Hi.
Good morning. I had a couple of questions. I was wondering if there were any varieties of viburnum or mock orange that are disease resistant here in Iowa and good growers in a soil mixture of clay and sand, maybe 8 feet tall and more of an upright habit?
Well, finding something that's upright is kind of difficult. Most shrubs tend to be just as wide as they are tall. I'm not worried a great deal about disease on the mock orange or the viburnums as a group. Sometimes you'll have things like powdery mildew on some types of viburnum, and they don't look that great, but it doesn't really affect their health or vigor that much. But as far as plants that I would look at, I would look at the arrowwood viburnum.
Arrowwood?
Right. That's actually native to parts of Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
And it grows about 8 foot tall. It is about 8 foot wide. It does produce creamy white flowers in clusters in the spring. After blooming, it does form berry-like fruit, which turn to blue, kind of a nice, very attractive blue in August. So that's kind of nice.
Do the leaves turn red in the fall?
The fall color is very inconsistent with that. Sometimes it's yellow, sometimes yellow to orange, sometimes with a little bit of purple in it, too. It varies from year to year. But it's a nice plant. It's very easy to grow. You can grow it in full sun to part shade. And there are some cultivars of that. For example, there's Blue Muffin is the name.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just covered with the blue fruit in late summer. And it's also a little bit smaller in size, typically more like 5 to 6 feet. So that would be a good possibility. Then you have the American Cranberry Bush Viburnum, which is a bigger plant, more toward maybe 8 to 10 feet. And it does produce berries that turn bright red in late summer, early fall. And the fall color can be kind of a wine red. And there are some smaller, more compact cultivars on that too. So you might want to look into the American Cranberry Bush Viburnum.
Okay.
And there are, as far as the mock oranges, they can be quite big plants. But the nice thing is, there are some smaller cultivars if size is a concern. Now, with the mock orange, for that plant to really bloom well, it needs full sun. If you put that in a shady location, part shade, the plant may not die, but it's not going to bloom much. And if it doesn't bloom much, it's not much of an asset because it doesn't have a nice fall color. Its main asset is its flowers in the spring.
Yes, the scent.
The white flowers and the scent. And they bloom basically late spring. So if you want them to bloom well, they basically do need full sun.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Well, thanks for calling, Sharon. We appreciate it. We'll go next to Dean in Davenport. Dean, welcome to Horticulture Day with Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron and Linda Nave. What's your question?
Well, thank you very much. I've got an abandoned building and with a vacant lot next to my yard, and it's been invaded with, I think it's black locust, and it's spread for like 250 feet by the edge of my yard. And for the last 30 years, there's been an electric line that goes right down the lot line, and the electric company used to come in and every once in a while cut down those trees all the way down my lot line, but this year they took out the building and the lines, and I'm thinking that those are going to grow up very tall and shade out my yard this year, or within the next few years. They grow incredibly fast, and I'm trying to figure out a way to keep those from, without having to actually cut them down every year, figure out a way to keep that from, and they've actually invaded my yard. And where I keep it mowed, it's not too much of a problem, except that I do have to keep it cut the back pretty well. But
this is a vacant lot, and do you have permission to go on to that vacant lot?
I've never gotten permission. I don't think anybody would ever mind. But
How thick are these trees?
I think. I think one approach would be maybe just to mow it periodically.
Some of them are already 30 or 40 feet tall. I mean, on the far side. But where they come onto my land, as I said, they used to cut them down every few years when they grew up into the electrical wires. And
well, if you have shoots coming up on your property, you can go out and you can cut them off, and you can apply Roundup directly to those cut surfaces. I would be concerned about doing that on someone else's property. But as far as maybe cutting it, I wouldn't feel as I don't know what's the word. I guess I would feel okay in doing that maybe, where you're making it look kind of better, so it's not just weeds, and you're not really killing anything. You're just going out there and just kind of making it a little bit more tidy so that it's more eye appealing. So I guess I would maybe be inclined to do that and not go out there and try to kill them with a herbicide or anything of that nature. But anything that comes up on my property is fair game.
That's right. But my question is right about on the other side of the lot line where they grow up, if they're going to grow up to be 30, 40 feet tall, and they're not very good trees.
Then the other thing, obviously, would be to contact the individual that does own the property and see what they're going to do, see if they would be amenable if you went in there and did some cleanup.
It's a real estate company. They're trying to sell the property, and they reside in St. Louis, and they don't.
Yeah.
You'll just have to contact them, Dina. It sounds like on their end, but for your side of it, it sounds like you can do what you want to do. Thanks for calling. We appreciate the call. We'll go next to Amos in Des Moines. What's your question, Amos, for Horticulture Day?
Yes, I have this grass, you know, that gets about like 3 to 4 feet high, you know, and I want to transplant some of it, and I'm wondering if it's too early to do it now. I already trimmed it back.
Oh, you've got an ornamental grass, I'm taking
it.
Yeah.
Right.
No, now's a great time to dig and divide ornamental grasses while they're still somewhat dormant. Some of our cool season grasses, such as feather reed grass, might be starting to come up. You'll see about 4 inches of growth on that now. But overall, our ornamental grasses are still dormant. Go ahead and dig them up. Get as much of the clump as possible, and you can divide it or move it at this time.
You can divide that grass, though.
Pretty much, yeah. Most all of them you can divide.
Really? I got a lot of it. I got a lot of it, and it just it gets really beautiful. And I wish there was some kind of way they could make fuel out of that grass.
Well,
you know how much that stuff, you realize how much it is on one, how much one plant produces? And I wonder why someone had did some. I mean, why?
Maybe they will. Amos, thanks for calling in. It sounds like you can divide the grass, and we appreciate the call.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll go next to Devin in Packwood. Devin, welcome to Horticulture Day. What's your question?
Yes, good morning. Thank
you. Good morning.
Actually, it's about strawberries. I planted some ever-bearing strawberries summer before last in about maybe 6 by 15 patch, and I only had like 6 strawberry plants, but they have completely taken over the entire patch, and I kind of let them go last year, and so I'm wondering if you have any tips on how I can kind of get them back under control.
Well, what you could do is maybe go out there this spring and do some thinning, where you might remove some of the plants. Where you can maybe develop little walkways in the patch where you can kind of walk in there and pull your weeds and harvest your fruit and things like that. So you could go out in the spring and kind of sacrifice some of the plants and kind of develop rows and spacing in there so that maybe those plants that remain could be a little bit more productive because they're not overcrowded.
Right.
So sometimes you have to just kind of bite the bullet and go out there and maybe eliminate a few plants.
Right. Now, I was trying to do some research on this, and I've come across some information that said that maybe it's best to keep the runners, like some of the runner plants that have established, and kind of like get rid of the older plants.
Well, typically with the everbearers, we tend to suggest that they actually pinch off the runners, that they maintain the patch as the mother plants. It's different than the June bearers. With the June bearers, we go out and renovate the bed, and as soon as they're done producing fruit in late June. And when we do that, we tend to eliminate the old plants and keep the younger plants. But with the everbearers and the day-neutral varieties, when we plant those, we typically suggest that you keep the mother plant, mm-hmm. that you go out and actually remove the runners that form. Most people don't do that. They allow the runners to form, and then the bed becomes very, very dense, very full, and the plants are not very productive that way.
Right. I did pull the I think I misunderstood, because I did pull the or trim pinch off the runners the first year,
mm-hmm.
and then it was the second year and they completely
took over,
became alive.
Well,
So I would do some thinning this spring and develop some rows and see if they don't produce better this year.
Okay.
Thanks,
Thank
Devin.
Much.
Well, we appreciate
Bye.
The call. Thank you. We'll go next to John in Cedar Rapids. Welcome to Horticulture Day. Listeners, if you'd like to call in at 1-866-780-9100, that's the number to call to talk to Richard Giron or Linda Nabe. John, welcome to the program. What's your question?
Yeah, I'm just kind of curious as to, is there any way to get rid of Creeping Charlie? I tried the borax stuff and it did not work.
Well, the ground ivy or Creeping Charlie is a pretty nasty weed. It's very hard to kill. There are some herbicides that work fairly effectively. You want to typically apply a product that contains either 2,4-D or triclopyr, which is T-R-I-C-L-O-P-Y-R. And those are fairly common ingredients in some of the broadleaf herbicides. Now, the best time to control ground ivy is in the fall. Typically sometime between late September, early November, and it usually takes two applications, about a month apart. Now, in the spring, if you want to apply an application, the best time is as the plants begin to bloom. They have those small little bluish flowers on them. That would be the best time in the spring. But the spring applications typically aren't as effective, so you may not get the control that you really want. But if you don't, then come back again and try in the fall. But it's a very aggressive plant. It grows very rapidly, and you might have a small little patch right now, but by late summer it could be fairly huge in comparison. It's very vigorous.
What I've tried before is raking it out and planting grass seed and trying to get the grass to establish.
Yeah, you cannot outcompete ground ivy. You simply cannot. It will not happen. Ground ivy is more vigorous than the grass no matter what you do. So you have to get rid of it somehow. You can't outcompete it. You just can't.
If you get it out of your yard, how do you keep it from like neighbor's yard invading your yard again?
Well, if it's in the neighbor's yard, I would strongly consider maybe developing a flower patch right at the edge where you keep it kind of plant-free, but you have your flowers in there. And if the ground ivy starts to creep back in, you can go out there and kill it in that zone between the lawn and the neighbors. Because once it gets in the lawn, it's very hard to control. But in a flower bed or something like that, you can pull it out, you can dig it out, you can do it. But once it gets into the yard, pulling and digging isn't very feasible.
Okay.
Thanks, John.
DMZ zone. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate the call. We've got an email from Marvin from Iowa City. He wants to know if it's normal for a newly planted rhododendron to lose its leaves in the spring.
Well, it kind of depends. There are evergreen types that should retain their foliage throughout the entire year. But if we have a really tough winter, I could see where during the wintertime some of the leaves may dry up and turn brown and fall off in late winter, early spring. Now, there are deciduous types that do lose their leaves normally in the fall of the year like other trees and shrubs do, and that's perfectly normal. But if they have an evergreen type, they should retain their foliage. And I can only see if they have a really bad winter, they might gradually kind of shrivel up and turn brown and fall off. The key would be, are they still alive? And if they are, then they'll put on new growth. So the loss is only temporary.
Okay. We'll go next to Audrey in Duncombe. Audrey, welcome to Horticulture Day. What's your question?
I have a long-established asparagus bed, but each year the grass seems to take over, and I'm wondering what I can use to get rid of this grassy invasion. Is there something that you can put on before the asparagus emerges, or... what?
Well, a lot of people fight that battle with grasses moving into their asparagus patch, primarily because it's perennial and the grasses move in with an underground rhizome. So what I would suggest you do, if you're not afraid to use Roundup, what you need to do with Roundup is you go out and harvest your asparagus so it's clean cut all the way, and you harvest it just below the soil surface. So take your knife, and when you harvest asparagus, just don't snap it off, but cut it just below the soil surface.
Okay.
And clean harvest the patch so you don't see any asparagus. Then you go out and you apply your quick-acting Roundup, glyphosate, and that should control and apply it to your grass when it's actively growing, which is about the time your asparagus is coming into production.
Right.
And that should take care of it pretty well for you. Now, it's not a long-term fix because the grasses will come back in, but it'll take care of it for pretty much this season.
Okay, that sounds great. I'll try it.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks for calling, Audrey. We appreciate the call. Well, we're out of time for this edition of Horticulture Day, but we'll be back next week. Thanks to Extension Horticulturists Richard Duran and Linda Knave, and thanks to all of you who called in today. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. We had techno assistance by Christina Sarnelli. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Julie Englander. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Julie. It's 10:54.